listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. Tonight on Right On Radio, Liz Olds will be talking with Michael Oberman, author of Fast Forward, Play, Rewind. Oberman became a weekly music columnist at age 19 and wrote an interview column for 6 years before leaving for a career in the music business. At age 50, he embarked on a new journey as a photographer. His photos are on permanent display in museums in the U.S. and Canada and have graced album covers, websites, galleries, and more. He currently lives in Columbia, Maryland.
And I'm Liz Olds. In the last part of the hour, David Fettig will be talking with Patricia Houlihan, the author of Hands and Hearts Together, Daily Meditations for Caregivers, just published by Holy Cow Press in Duluth. Houlihan has also published a memoir, Books for Parents and Mothers, and on the subject of teenage girls. She has been teaching at the Loft Literary Center and at Metropolitan State University for over 20 years. All of this and more, stay tuned for Right On Radio. Michael, are you there?
I am here in Columbia, Maryland.
Columbia, Maryland. Well, I'm a Marylander too, so we have some things in common. Do you have something to read to start with?
If you'd like me to start that way, yeah.
That'd be great.
Let me give a little background to what I'm going to read, because my book is made up of over 100 interviews I did with major musical artists, and then what I call musings, my thoughts after or before or during, et cetera. So I'm going to read a musing, and I think that I picked one out that's kind of appropriate because this weekend was the 5th anniversary of the death of David Bowie, who I first interviewed in 1969, and again in the early 70s, and who, when he arrived in the United States in January of 1971, his first time here, he spent his first day with me, my brother, and my parents in Silver Spring, Maryland. So it's kind of an interesting story because there's a movie that just came out called Stardust that is supposed to be based on that trip. I think when I read my musings, you'll see why I think it's really not totally based on the trip. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is titled Musings, End of January 1971. My brother brings David Bowie to the United States. David becomes Ziggy Stardust. David's death in January 2016 was like a punch in the gut to me. I first wrote about David in 1969. I had spoken with him on the phone before I wrote my column about him in 69. It was a brief conversation centered around his song, Space Oddity. My brother had sent me a copy of the single and encouraged me to write about David. David and I were contemporaries, at least in terms of age. We were both born in 1947. A number of artists I interviewed between 1967 and 73 had died young. Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Otis Redding. Whether accidental overdose, or as in the case of Otis Redding, a plane crash. If you survive drug abuse and the fast life of rock and roll and made it past age 50, you had a chance to live another few decades unless illness or accident befell you. Cancer took David at age 69. The gut punch to me was that I knew David personally as he spent his first day in the U.S. in January 1971 with me, my brother, and my parents. My brother Ron was director of publicity for Mercury Records, Bowie's American label at the time. David was already a star in Great Britain and Europe, but he hadn't really broken big in the United States. Ron decided to bring David to America to do a promotional tour and meet the press, DJs, and others who could help David's career in the US. David flew from London to Dulles Airport in Virginia. Ron had flown in from Chicago, where Mercury Records was headquartered. David had told Ron that he wanted to spend his first day in the US with an American family. Ron saw that as an opportunity for me and my parents to spend time with David. After all, I had already written about Bowie And this would give Ron a chance to spend some time with his own family while giving David a chance to spend time with an American family. So the Oberman family went to Dulles Airport to pick up David Bowie. When David's flight arrived, he was held up in customs for a bit longer than we expected. It might have been his hair or his clothing, or maybe just chance, that caused the slight delay before he came out of customs. He wasn't upset. In fact, he had a huge smile when he saw my brother and my parents. Ron had previously been to England and spent time with David there. Ron believed in David as an artist and really wanted to see him achieve success in the U.S., success that had eluded him in this country so far. After arriving at my parents' home on Admiralty Drive in Silver Spring, we all sat in the living room to have some refreshments and chat. Conversation flowed smoothly. David already knew what Ron and I did for a living. David was curious about my father's work. My father, told David about his job as branch manager for National Bohemian Beer. And David was delighted. He asked my father for a business card to have as a memento. After giving David one of his business cards, my mother stood up with her trusty Instamatic camera and snapped the photo of me, Ron, and David seated on the living room sofa. David has my father's business card in his hand in the photo. The reason I mention this is that the photo has appeared in many publications. It was the second photo taken of David on his first trip to the U.S. The first photo was taken at Dulles Airport. People have emailed me, texted me, and messaged me on social media, most saying they thought David had a joint in his hand, when in reality it was my father's business card. After an hour or two at my parents' home, we all went to Emerson's restaurant in Silver Spring, not Huffberg's Deli, as some publications have reported. The hostess at the restaurant seated us in a booth and proceeded to close the curtains on our booth. We all had a good laugh over that. After dinner, we dropped my parents back home, and David, my brother, and I went to my house in Tacoma Park. Besides writing for the Star, I had also managed a band called Claude Jones and had co-managed a band called Sky Cobb. When we got to my house, the members of Sky Cobb were in my living room passing a bong around. The band didn't even try to communicate with David, something that some of them regret to this day. David had never seen a bong before, and no, he did not partake of the substance in the bong. Late that night, David went to his hotel in D.C. and left the next day. An interesting fact for all Bowie fans, David went to Mercury headquarters on East Wacker Drive in Chicago. After a meeting in my brother's office, Ron handed David several 45 RPM records that were on the Mercury and Smash labels. One of those records was called Paralyzed by the legendary Stardust Cowboy. David took a fancy to Paralyzed, and on that 1971 promotional tour of the United States, David decided to use Stardust from the legendary Stardust Cowboy as part of his new persona, Ziggy Stardust. To this day, among my brother's many achievements in the music business, his giving David Bowie Paralyzed ranks high on the list. While I wrote a second column on David in 1972, it didn't contain any of the facts of David's 1971 trip to America. Those facts felt too personal to me at the time. Over the years, the photo my mother took of Bowie, me, and my brother sitting on the living room couch has appeared in a number of publications. Now let's fast forward to February of 2019. I just received word that Backbeat Books wanted to publish the book you are now reading. Well, you're not reading it. I'm reading it to you. A few days later, I heard from a friend in England that Salon Pictures, a British film company that had made films including Churchill and My Weekend with Marilyn, had announced they were making a film titled Stardust. The film was to be an account of Bowie's 1971 trip to the U.S. and how he adopted the persona of Ziggy Stardust. I went to my computer, Googled Salon Pictures and Stardust, and found out it was true. As I read more details, I became frustrated. Salon had cast comedian and podcaster Mark Maron to play my brother. Maron was 55 years old. My brother was 27 years old in 1971 when Bowie came to the U.S. Maron was old enough to be my brother's father, I thought. How else is Salon going to fictionalize the movie? I took a chance and sent an email to one of the partners in Salon Pictures. I explained my Bowie connection and told him I was available to give his company facts about David's trip to the U.S. He responded with an email saying that he would like to put the screenwriter and director in touch with me. He CC'd both the screenwriter Chris Bell and the film's director Gabriel Range. 6 months went by before I received an email from the film's director saying he would love to talk with me, and he arranged to phone me from London. So in August 2019, Gabriel Range phoned me from England. I asked him when the film was going into production. He responded, "Oh, we just wrapped up 18 days of filming in Hamilton, Canada." I was shocked. Where did they get the facts for the film? My brother, who unfortunately had dementia, couldn't have told the story to anyone. My parents are dead. I was the only one who could give a firsthand account of David's first day in the U.S., and I hadn't been asked by anyone in Salon Pictures to give my account. The director also told me the movie was more of a buddy picture, including David and Ron's trip across the United States. I realized that since that road trip across the United States never happened, the film was going to be highly fictionalized. I'm going to end reading this part now just to say that when I wrote my book, the film hadn't come out. The film is out now. It was on video on demand. It premiered in the U.S. on November 25th. I spent the $12 to rent it and watched it and was horrified. Mm. I have since been in touch with the woman in the film who plays my mother, with the actor in the film who plays me, and the filmmakers didn't get permission. And, you know, I hate to say it, but from that point on, I knew the film was going to be dreadful, and it was. In fact, it didn't open in Great Britain until this week. And I was interviewed in The Sun, the London tabloid newspaper, the sensationalist newspaper. The story came out this weekend, where the reviewer who reviewed the movie had me refute most of the scenes, scene by scene. So it's kind of a weird time, and a lot of my interviews have been skewed towards the Bowie story, and for good reason. But let me ask you, Liz, I mean, what in the book struck you that you might like to ask me about?
Boy, it was all very interesting. But the first thing that struck me actually isn't one of the stories. It's about your relationship with your brother and how you got to Column and how he inspired you. And I was wondering if you would be willing to talk a little bit about Ron.
Yeah, you know, I was 16 years old and Ron was 4 years older than me. So I was a 16-year-old high school student. And Ron was working at the Evening Star while attending the University of Maryland. He started as a copy boy, and he got that job through his best buddy, Carl Bernstein, who people may know from Bernstein and Woodward, et cetera. Still a great friend and a talking head on CNN. And I asked my brother if he could get me a job as a copy boy. And he did. So at age 16, on weekends, I was working at the Washington Star as a copy boy, which is a nice name for being a schlep. Basically, you're in the newsroom and somebody else copy and you go do what they tell you they want you to do. Well, as luck would have it, my brother began writing a column called Top Tunes in February of 1964. Very important month in Washington music history, and actually in music history period, because the Beatles came to the United States. And their first live performance, other than the Ed Sullivan Show, their first concert was in Washington, D.C. And my brother said, "You want to come with me?" Well, of course I wanted to come with him. He interviewed the Beatles that night. I wasn't privy to that. I sat waiting for him in the car to finish. And I came out of there, my head was spinning. I thought, gosh, Ron, you've got the greatest job in the world. Mm-hmm. Plus, you're meeting all these beautiful women because of what you're doing. They all want to go backstage with you. Well, Ron continued writing the column for 3 years. And let me open my book and just, if I do a sequel to this book, it will contain Ron's column. But if I go through his 1964 list, the Marquettes, the Beatles, James Brown, the Four Seasons, the Beach Boys, Diane Reney, Elvis Presley, Marvin Gaye, I mean, Peter and Gordon, Mary Wells, the Dave Clark Five. The Dave Clark Five was funny because it was a phone interview. My brother was still living at home and I was home. And there was a young girl, she was maybe 14, who lived across the street, Joni Hollow Center. She heard that Ron was going to be interviewing the Dave Clark Five by phone. She asked if she could get on an extension. And Ron said, well, yeah, but don't say a word. Well, she got on the extension and squealed like a stuck pig. She went hysterical. There was the Dave Clark Five. The unfortunate story, I mean, you know, which I didn't put in the book, but I think about it all the time, is that when she was in her late 30s, Joan Hollow Center, who was a friend, was murdered by her husband.
Ooh.
Yeah, sad story. Anyway, let's go on to happier things. In 1967, at the beginning of 1967, when I was still in journalism school at the University of Maryland, working as a copy boy, Ron told me he was offered a job at Mercury Records in Chicago, at that point as assistant director of publicity. I said, wow, you're moving to Chicago. I thought, I want that job. I want to write the music column. So the editor of that section's name was Fifi Gorska, Countess Fifi Gorska. And she was a great woman. I went up to her and I said, Fifi, I want to write the top tunes column. And she said, Michael, you're 19 years old. You're still in journalism school. We've got guys here with their master's degrees who would like to write that column. I said, Fifi, you remember Ron was 20 and still in journalism school when he started writing the column. And she told me, okay, write three. We'll see how it goes. And that those three turned into 300. So I stayed there every week. I wrote my column. I started managing artists to stop being a copy boy and would come into the paper one day a week to drop off my copy for my column. And it was a heady time. Well, my brother had the British invasion and I caught the tail end of that as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I had the psychedelic era. So I interviewed the Jefferson Airplane, Jimi Hendrix, from the folk scene, Joni Mitchell, a rare interview in the dressing room at the Cellar Door nightclub, which was, you're being from the Maryland area, I'm sure you knew of the Cellar Door.
Yeah, and Joni Mitchell doesn't give many interviews, that's for sure.
No, she didn't. In fact, they asked permission. They have the interview up on the Joni Mitchell website now.
Oh.
So it was a great run, but the money wasn't very good. And in 1973, kind of synchronicity here, a friend of mine who worked for Warner Electra Atlantic said, how would you like to come to work at Warner Electra Atlantic? That was the distribution arm for Warner Brothers, Elektra, and Atlantic Records. And it was a foot in the door to work for a record company. So that's kind of a speedy segue out of my writing and into what I started doing after writing, which was working in the music business. And I was with Warner Electra Atlantic for a year before I decided that wasn't where I wanted to be, but it was a great year. Atlantic Records had their 25th anniversary party in Paris, took 800 people there for a week. Imagine dinner in Paris with Stephen Grappelli serenading your table. It was an incredible time. That same year, Elektra Records had their convention at a dude ranch in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Boom, another great week. When I left Warner Elektra Atlantic, I went to work for a man named Jack Boyle, who owned the Cellar Door Nightclub, and he wanted to start producing concerts. He figured that he could sell Gordon Lightfoot out for two straight weeks at the Cellar Door, seven nights a week. Why couldn't he do Gordon Lightfoot for one night at Constitution Hall with 3,800 seats rather than the Cellar Door for 14 nights? And he would bring in the same amount of money. That's how Cellar Door concerts started. And while I was there, we got the contract to do every show at the Capitol Center.
All right.
18,000 seat venue. So we were doing nightclubs, Constitution Hall, the Kennedy Center, the Warner Theater, the Capitol Center, and that turned my life topsy-turvy. Oh, my days were endless. It was an incredible learning experience. But I knew that Jack and his partner Sam were making oodles of money, and I was working my rear end off, and they didn't pay very well. I left there to manage artists, and that lasted for a good part of my life, managing acts. And I've got some chapters on that in my book also.
Yeah, the book has so many stories, and we're actually running out of time. But why don't you tell the one story that you suggested to me? Tell me about moon landing and who you watched the moon landing
with. Okay, well, I won't even read that. That's so embedded in my memory that I'll just talk about it.
You got about 2 minutes.
Okay. I had interviewed Blind Faith via the phone, and now they were in America, and they were going to be playing at the Baltimore Civic Center. And it happened to be the same night as America sending the first manned spacecraft to the moon. And I was torn. Do I stay home and watch this on television, or do I go say hi to Eric and Ginger, et cetera? So I went to the Baltimore Civic Center, and boom, Blind Faith had a small television set in the dressing room. The show was postponed by 40 minutes so they could watch the first landing on the moon. And I sat back there with Eric Clapton, Rick Gretsch, Ginger Baker, and Stevie Winwood, watched the man first footsteps on the moon. And the crowd out there, there were no big screen TVs or anything then. They didn't know what was going on. Mm. You know, we want Blind Faith. Eventually Blind Faith came out and explained, oh, we had to watch the moon landing. And so that, you know, we all have events that have happened in our life that we'll never forget we were.
Absolutely.
And that was one of them for me.
Yeah, Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker and et cetera, watching the moon landing with them is a good memory. And that's where we're going to have to stop, Michael. We could talk for hours about stuff in this book, but we're talking with Michael Oberman, author of Fast Forward, Play, and Rewind, a book of interviews, but also musings about life in the music business. And we'll have to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us tonight.
Liz, it was my pleasure, and I know that you're probably colder up there in Minneapolis than we are in Columbia, Maryland, but hey. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now this.
Annie?
Yeah, Dave, are you with us?
Yes.
Excellent. All right, you can take it away. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Hello, my name's Dave. Welcome back to Right on Radio, and I am joined on Zoom by Patricia Houlihan. I just turned off my radio so we wouldn't get that feedback. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Did you hear that note on the calendar, poetry, prose, and pastries? Boy, I think it's a nice idea.
Awesome. It's a great idea.
It's a great idea. So glad to have you here. The book is Hands and Heart Together, Daily Meditations for Caregivers. And Patricia, before we get started, I wonder if you might tell us a little bit about yourself as a writer and some of your previous works, then that led up to this book, so we can sort of get a sense for how this fits into your life.
Awesome. Thank you. Yes, I've been a writer for a long time, also a long time writing instructor at The Loft and at Metro State. I have written three previous meditation books, and they kind of follow the course of my life. So the first one I did was for Mothers in Recovery, which Bantam published that back in the early 90s. And then I did a book for teenage girls, which Holy Cow Press also published, which published this current one too. And that was the one for teenage girls was in 2001. And then I did one for the Search Institute in 2007, which was for, it's called A Moment's Peace for Parents of Teens. I was a parent of teen at the time. I also did another book for the Search Institute on the trans, it's called Parenting Through the Transition, you know, of helping kids leave high school and move on to whatever is next. And then I, 5 years ago, published a memoir called Storm Prayers, Retrieving and Reimagining Matters of the Soul.
Good for you.
So that's my history in publishing. Yeah,
that's tremendous. Congratulations on all of that. So how about, let's get started with the reading. This again is a meditation book.
Yes.
So listeners can get a sense for what this is all about, and then we'll dig in a little bit.
Excellent. The meditation, I wanted to explain a little bit the meditation book format for any listeners who are not familiar with it. So there's an opening quote, and I am really deeply grateful to all the writers, musicians, philosophers, theologians, whose work I have used in quotes. They really helped me with the writing, and I think they give a real richness to the book. So the format is an opening quote, and then I have two paragraphs that sort of take the idea and go into it in depth, and then a closing thought for the day. So visually on the paper, the quote is in bold. My writing, my two paragraphs are in sort of regular print, and then the closing thought for the day is in italics. So I will try to read it so you could visualize that as I read.
Very good.
So I'm going to start with...
I can't wait to hear you reading in italics, Patricia. This is going to be fascinating.
Yes, me too. We'll see how I do with that.
I'm sure you will. Let's go.
Exactly. I'm choosing this one for the opening reading because of the quote itself, because it covers a lot of important ground about caregiving.
Great. So,
quote, there are only four kinds of people in the world: those who have been caregivers, those who are currently caregivers, those who will be caregivers, and those who will need a caregiver. And that quote is from Rosalind Carter, former First Lady. This live statement reminds all of us of the many sides of the caregiving prism. It is multifaceted. At some point in time, most of us will be in need of a caregiver, who knows where or when. And the rest of us have either already been a caregiver or we are immersed in it right now. If you are reading these words, you are probably in the thick of it. What you are learning today will inform those around you who will become caregivers in the years to come. The prism of caregiving has many sides and dimensions to it. Prisms and windows catch the sunlight and cast dancing rainbows all around. Compassionate caregiving also catches sunlight and sends rays of color and light into the past, the present, and the future. Let my approach to caregiving catch light where I can and reflect it for my loved one, for myself, and for all the potential and future caregivers around me. And then my italicized voice.
Yep.
Roles change over time. Let me honor my role as a caregiver today. Let me imagine this role as a prism, catching and transforming the light of this day.
Thank you. That was Patricia Houlihan reading from her book of meditations for caregivers, Hands and Heart Together. Patricia, that is one of the meditations I had pulled out that I wanted to talk to you about. So that's fantastic. We're on the same wavelength.
Oh, excellent.
And I did want to also talk about the format. But before we do that, let's define caregiver, just so we know what we're talking about. How do you define caregiver?
Oh, that is an excellent question. That is a really excellent question. You'd think I'd have an answer at the tip of my tongue. I mean, it is a role that one takes on when you are doing a lot of caring for somebody who is vulnerable in some way or another. And I know that the preferred term is caregiving, not caretaking, because it implies more of a relationship. And I really think caregiving is a very intimate kind of a relationship, because vulnerability opens us up in unusual ways, even if we're the one taking care of the vulnerable one. So I think of it as helping someone through a difficult time, being there for someone through a difficult time, showing up for somebody who's going through a difficult period. A lot of my book is oriented towards aging, or, you know, a family member who is sick or aging, but it does have a broader dimension than that too.
Sure. I can speak from personal experience, and I'm sure most, if not all of our listeners can, based on the Rosalind Carter quote, that she is exactly right.
Yes.
I think to come upon a book like this, prior to, rather than after you're deep in the middle of caregiving, at any point it comes in handy, but it's never too early to start thinking about your role as a caregiver. I think that's, you would probably agree with that.
I would totally agree with that, because I wrote this book after the fact, because I wrote the book I wished I'd had when I was in the thick of caregiving. I mean, I'll probably go into that role again in the future, but I did it for quite a few years, and I really longed for a book that would address its particular challenges.
Yeah. And of course, you've written a number of books on meditations, and the nice thing is it stops you and slows you down, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Poetry. So let's talk about the structure. A quote, and then your words, and then the actual, I guess, what would be the meditation at the bottom. How did you come up with that? And you really set yourself an impressive task to fill in that page with a couple paragraphs. That's not easy to do. I mean, this is a 365-page meditation book, very nicely laid out and designed, and fits right in the palm of your hand, ladies and gentlemen, I might add. It really feels good. But you set yourself up for a lot of work there.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, thank you for acknowledging that. And by the way, it's 366, because I wrote one for leap day also. but why did I? I just felt highly motivated. I felt like it was a book that was missing and could be very useful in the world. Like I said, it was the book I wished I'd had when I was in the thick of it. So I was highly motivated. And after a few rejections, Jim Perlman at Holy Cow Press said yes. And for him, I'm very grateful for that. And he definitely encouraged me all along the way. I would say finding 366 quotes was a staggering job, and a pretty big percentage of the process. If I had a good quote, it was always easier for me to write from that. It is an interesting format. I mean, it's a kind of a tried and true format. I didn't invent it. There are quite a few different kinds of meditation books out there, but this particular format, I think, works really well. Your comment about how it fits in the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
It's easily accessible. It's short. Caregivers are busy. You can read it in 5 minutes, and hopefully it can kind of shed a light on that particular day, or what's going on for you. So for all those reasons, it's a easy way to slow down, take a few minutes.
Yeah, no, it's really nicely done. So did you think about this in terms of progression? That is to say, is there a reason why a quote's on April 4th as opposed to October 22nd?
Well,
invitation? Is there, you know?
some of it's kind of random. It's not a progression through the year, just because I was envisioning people going through a lot of different processes at a different time. So mostly it's random, except for, you know, ones that center around holidays or certain times of the year, or seasons. Some of them are sort of seasonal. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I just kind of tried to provide when I was putting them together, I mean, because I organized them differently from how I wrote them. I was just kind of looking for maybe a variety of tools, so to speak.
Oh, I see. Sure.
Throughout the course of a week or a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Right. I'd like to back up and talk about the title of the book. I think it often reveals a lot about what's inside. The subtitle is pretty straightforward, Daily Meditations for Caregivers. That could have been the title, but you know, that's not terribly exciting. Hands and Heart Together. What did you mean by those words?
That really comes from the fact that in my experience with caregiving, it is very much a demanding very practically, which is the hands part, hands on. Okay. There are a lot of, like when I think about my mother's last 6 months, say, there was a lot of taking care of details and, you know, things around her living place. That was very hands on. But it's also a very much, I think, at its best, a heart opening and a heart challenging experience. Mm-hmm. So it's very emotional at the same time. It's emotionally intense. So hands and heart together. I actually fooled around with a couple of different ideas with hands and heart. And actually, my publisher, Jim Perlman, and I, we kind of came up with that together as being the favorite one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely a hands and heart together experience.
Yeah, that's well said. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So you seem like someone who's very self-reflective, and you've written other meditation books. So people might find it curious, or I'll just speak for myself, that, you know, you went through this experience with your mother. We can talk about more of that if you like. There's some value in sharing some of those stories sometimes, but that you didn't, you know, meditation did not occur to you during that time. Maybe it did, but I take the sense from you that it was after the fact that you realized, boy, I just went through something and I could really help other people out. Is that what happened?
Well, that's not quite it. I've been a daily reader of daily meditation books for a very long time. So it's part of my practice, so to speak. In the morning, I read and I write in my journal. And so I was reading books that were somewhat helpful. I just felt like during that time, I could have used something that was a little bit more focused on the experience of caregiving. Because it's very difficult. I think at times it was very difficult to continually feed my sense of worth in that role. And so one of the things I really tried to do in this book is to keep honoring the importance of the role. And I don't think caregivers can hear that enough, because we tend to get very worn down in the process.
Yeah. You know, we're told that our generation, the sandwich generation, right? Because we have kids and we have parents who are living older and who have more and more needs, that this phenomenon is more and more upon us. You know, we don't have any data in front of us, at least I don't, unless you have someone in your back pocket that you want to share. But that seems to be the case. I mean, is it your experience that friends and family and other people in your circle are going through this more than, you know, otherwise?
I think so. And then I think COVID also sort of opens up a wider horizon of need for caregiving and need to be kind of inventive and creative in caregiving. So yes, and for me, there was a history of caregiving. I did it for my mother and father. My mother was the last one to leave us. So she's kind of the one that stayed in my memory the most. And I also had two aunts and an uncle who were very formative in my life, who I helped take care of, because they didn't have children of their own. So, yeah.
Well, as my grandmother used to say, you've put a lot of jewels on your house in heaven or some dang thing, whatever that's saying.
Well, the great thing is that all those people taught me a lot about how to be a caregiver. So in reality, I was giving back some of what they had been giving me over the years.
So would you consider yourself a giving person? And to what degree does it, in terms of caregiving, we're not all born to be caregivers, I don't think. Maybe we are. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Tell me about if you've ever reflected on, you know, people's ability, the type of emotional stamina they may have to do these sorts of things.
Yes, I don't think everyone is cut out for it. On the other hand, I think people can be surprised by being able to rise to the occasion when the need is there. And in my family, I wouldn't have necessarily been the most obvious one. I did a lot of caregiving with my sister, who's a nurse, and she would have been the more obvious caregiver. But I also felt really called to it. So I do think it requires an ability or a willingness to go into difficult moments and kind of be there in an intimate way when somebody's going through a very hard time. Yeah. It's true, not everybody's cut out for it. On the other hand, I think some people, I've talked to a lot of people about this, and I know some people would think I wasn't the likely candidate, but there really was nobody else. I needed to step in. I needed to do it, and I discovered I could do it. So I think that happens too. I think it can open up people in surprising ways.
Yeah, great. Remind our listeners, we are speaking with Patricia Houlihan, the author of the just published Hands and Heart Together, Daily Meditations for Caregivers. Patricia, how about another reading?
Okay, great. One question. Do you think there'll be time for two more or just one more?
Well, if we want to do two more, we certainly can. It looks like we have time, yes.
Okay, so then I'm going to read. Okay, this is the one. This is the one my husband really wanted me to read, so I'm going to read it. it's an April reading, which is also kind of a nice thought to think of April. Right now. So the quote, "When the month of Ramadan arrives, the doors of mercy are opened," by Sahi Muslim. "One evening in April, early April, I was walking around the city lake near my home. Tucked behind a parked van were two men on prayer mats, heads bowed down to the ground in evening prayer. They faced the direction of the soon-to-be setting sun. They were just slightly off the beaten track, yet all around them zoomed bikes and cars and people walking and talking. I was moved by their quiet focus, by the peacefulness they exuded, by their silent but open practice of their faith. Just seeing them made me feel more reverent toward the evening, the sun making its way across the lake and through the just barely budding trees. My Muslim friend reminds me that Ramadan is a month for mercy, for forgiveness, for blessings. Who among us doesn't need more of all of these? Inside the busyness of caregiving, there are many reminders all around us of our shared human need for mercy. That is one of the beauties of our wider world. In the midst of our days of caregiving, let us remember to seek the blessing of mercy. It is a deep human need."
That's very beautiful, Patricia. Do you write poetry?
I do write poetry. Yes,
I can tell. It's lovely writing. And I, you know, hearing that, that's a meditation for everyone, really. And including your meditation on the bottom, where you directed to caregivers specifically. Well, you take caregiver out of there and just say you, that's for all of us, right?
Thank you.
That's a compliment. And I mean that. That's right. Well, thank you for sharing that.
I love hearing that. Thank you.
Yeah. For me, my daily meditations are the Stoic philosophers. I love those guys. But thank you for that. Where was I going to take this now? Oh, it's nice to hear you read these things. What's your experience with audio? And like, if not audio books, listening to meditations. I mean, this would be a really nice audio book, I guess is what I'm saying.
Oh, what a great idea. I love that. Yeah.
I don't know. I just throw that out there.
Thank you. I have never made an audio book, but I love the idea of it.
Yeah, there's something about it with meditations and the sort of the lyrical writing that I think it would work well. But
Thank you.
You have another one in particular, maybe you have more than one. It's on August 23rd. It talks about the toll of caregiving. Oh. Do you want to talk about that, just that topic, the toll of caregiving?
Yes.
If you would.
Yes.
Feel free to reference it if you want. It's August 23rd, but it's
struck. I see that one. I think one of the most surprising things for me about caregiving, especially with my mother, was how emotionally demanding it was. Yeah. And how many days I ran up against either fatigue or, you know, difficult personal, like feeling guilty or feeling like I wasn't doing enough, or, you know, even though I'd done a whole lot. And I think that those are some of the difficult challenges. That quote, just a little bit of it from Henry Nouwen is, but caregiving takes a toll. One of my themes in here is how important it is to keep trying to feed yourself in some way, because it's so easy to get drained by the experience. Into one of my meditations, I know I wrote about a morning when I met some friends for coffee and I like wanted to put my head down on the table. I think I might've just put my hand on my head and I just said, I've never done anything so hard in my life. And it surprised me that it was so hard, but it was at times. It was also a very beautiful experience and tender, and I'm grateful to have had it, but it was also very hard and demanding.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the benefits of a book like this. It can remind you that you're not alone.
Exactly. And definitely not alone. According to ARP, 43 million family caregivers in our country. Man.
Is that right?
Yes.
So you do have some data in your back pocket. Thank you. 43 million. Wow. Well, you're going to be rich when they all buy one of your books. That's amazing.
Well, my fingers are crossed.
I have a couple, two or three people on my list for a gift, and they're going to get this book. But we're going to run out of time really quickly, Patricia. It always happens. So if you wanted to get another reading in for us, that'd be lovely. Do you have something in mind?
I have one I wanted to do for a closing. So we'll go for that. Quote, "Love is not consolation, it is light," by Simone Weil. In a world spinning with changes, for instance, with the arrival of COVID-19 or the arrival of health issues in a loved one, there's often a sense that we can count on nothing. What felt like solid ground beneath us has become unsteady. Our footing is off balance and unsure. In times like this, I am always grateful for the way the sun rises every morning. Every evening, it exits beyond our view. But at times when we can count on little else, we can count on this amazing steadiness of how our planet moves in relationship with that most powerful star, the sun. Difficult things always seem more doable in daylight. Fears are often diminished in the light of day. Love is like this steady light, and love illumines what the darkness hides. Love is a much stronger force than fear. Each day we are awash in the steadiness of sunlight and the steadfastness of love.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Again, that was Patricia Houlihan reading from her book, Hands and Heart Together, Daily Meditations for Caregivers. Patricia, caregiving affects more people than the caregiver and the one being cared for, right? Yes. I think we get really focused on that really tight bond, that relationship, but something, you know, tells me your husband was involved in this too, other people in the family, and it's kind of a web. Is that right?
Absolutely. And in my preface and in my acknowledgments, I acknowledge all the other people. I mean, I have seven siblings. Everybody helped out. Mm-hmm. My husband held me together through so much of it. My friends helped me through it. It is a web, and it really requires and invites layers and layers of support. In my introduction, I say, if you're the person who brings food to the caregiver, you're an important part. You matter. You're an important part of this whole process.
So that's an interesting point. So there are caregivers for caregivers, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky. And the best caregivers, I'm sure, have people caregiving to them and honoring what they're doing and supporting them.
It seems like an important point.
Absolutely.
Boy, we're getting so close here to the end. There was one. What do we take? November 22nd, I had to write this down in my notebook. A quote from a person I never heard before, Howard Thurman. Uh-huh. He says, follow the grain in your own wood.
Yes.
Can you give us a nice little description of him? I love that image, even though I don't know what to do with it.
Well, there isn't time to read that whole meditation, yes. But I think there is no cookie cutter way to be a caregiver, as there's no cookie cutter way to be a human being. And that following the grain in your own wood is the way that I worked with that, was the idea of listening to your own intuition, listening to your loved one, finding creative and inventive ways to honor who you, the caregiver, are, who the loved one is. That's how that quote spoke to me. Don't be afraid to find your own way here. Don't be afraid to experiment. And if you have a crazy idea, go for it.
Great. Beautiful. Yeah. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, if you are not a caregiver, you know someone who is, and it's called Hands and Heart Together. Google it. It's by Patricia Houlihan. Patricia, before I get the 10-second warning or whatever they're about to do here, what are you up to next? What's next for Patricia Houlihan?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not quite sure what's up next. This just came out, and I mean, I'm writing a lot about everything that's going on in the world, which there's, you know, an enormous amount, but I'm not quite sure what the next shape or form is quite yet. So, and I'm healing a broken wrist. So,
oh, okay. Is there a story there?
Yes. I broke it while I was ice skating.
Wow.
That's the story.
Well, you're never too old to ice skate, right? Good for you. So tell us about we need to wrap. Well, there it is. Patricia Houlihan, Hands and Heart Together, Daily Meditations for Caregivers. What a delight to meet you and have this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Michael Oberman and Patricia Houlihan, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found.